It's Encounter on the Voice of America. Encounter on the Voice of America brings together advocates and opponents debating the critical issues of our time in a freewheeling, no-holds-barred discussion of fact and opinion. With today's guests and the topic for Encounter, here is Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this edition of the program, what is the significance of the Nigerian terrorist group Boko Haram's Pledge of Allegiance to the self-declared Islamic State, also known in Arabic as Daesh? And what is the status of Daesh in its stronghold of Syria and Iraq? Hello again, I'm Carol Castiel. Boko Haram, whose name means Western education is sinful, emerged as a local insurgency around 2009, but it has increasingly become a regional threat with wider ambitions, as evidenced by its recent statements of affiliation with the self-declared Islamic State. Nigerian President Goodluck Jonathan told VOA in a recent interview that Boko Haram fighters were being trained at camps run by the so-called Islamic State militants, but declined to mention specific countries. Meantime, the Boko Haram insurgency is one of the central issues in Nigeria as Mr. Jonathan runs for re-election. The poll was rescheduled once because of Boko Haram-related violence and fighting in the Northeast. Nigerians go to the polls on March 28th. Well, for more on the connection between Boko Haram and the self-declared Islamic State, also known as ISIS or ISIL, as well as the overall status of the latter, we turn to two distinguished analysts. J. Peter Pham is a regular at the VOA microphones. He's director of the Africa Center at the Atlantic Council. That's a policy group based here in Washington. And Michael O'Hanlon. He's senior fellow and co-director with the Center for 21st Century Security and Intelligence and director of research for the Foreign Policy Program at the Brookings Institution, and that's a policy group also based here in Washington. And J. Peter Pham joins me here at the VOA Broadcast Center. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Carol.
And I'd like to welcome Michael O'Hanlon. He joins us from a studio at the Brookings Institution. Michael, welcome to you.
Nice to be with you.
To you, Peter Pham, first here in the studio. What do you make of Boko Haram's pledge of fealty to the so-called Islamic State? Do we have any concrete evidence of collaboration, arms, money, or is this more of a public relations move?
Well, it's all of the above, Carol. For the last year, the two groups, Boko Haram in Nigeria and the so-called Islamic State, have been courting each other through cyberspace, so to speak, giving shout-outs to each other. For example, when Boko Haram kidnapped those more than 200 schoolgirls from Chibok last spring, ISIS, in its magazine, Dabiq, actually cited that, praised it, and cited it as a precedent for its treatment of the Yazidi women and girls in Iraq. And then there have been compliments paid when the Islamic State proclaimed the caliphate. Abu Bakr Shekau, the leader of Boko Haram, sent his greetings to it. Then in more recent months, we've seen a closer collaboration, at least on the media front. Several ISIS media outlets have helped push out Boko Haram content. And in the last 2 months, we've seen actually Boko Haram content really taking off in a much more sophisticated, much better produced way that's much more characteristic in the past of ISIS. So we suspect there's some back-channel collaboration. And then we have this declaration recently of allegiance by Boko Haram's leader to Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi. And this is a declaration, I would say, based on opportunism. Both groups are in the same situation. They're both on the defensive for the first time in a long time. Boko Haram is suffering tremendous losses of territory. It had, up to one point, held more territory than the size of Belgium in northeastern Nigeria. Now it's been much reduced. And of course, ISIS has been suffering under both Kurdish and now Iraqi government forces going on the offensive.
Turning to you, Michael O'Hanlon, for your take on the significance of this declaration by Boko Haram of allegiance to the so-called Islamic State. Anything to add or subtract to what Peter Pham just told us?
Well, Peter did a great job and I think explained it really nicely. You know, in operational terms, it probably doesn't increase the capacity of either group, but it does create this ongoing sense that ISIL has momentum. And in a world in which we had hoped obviously with the killing of Osama bin Laden and other accomplishments, let's say the Iraq surge of 2007, 2008, we had hoped there was a point at which the broader threat of what you might call Al-Qaeda-ism or this sort of cataclysmic, apocalyptic caliphate concept of Islamic extremism, we had hoped that was on the ropes. President Obama campaigned in 2012 for re-election, trying to say we were on the path towards decimating Al-Qaeda, even though these groups are not Al-Qaeda per se. And in fact, ISIL and Al-Qaeda are on poor terms. Nonetheless, the whole movement has gotten a huge shot in the arm, mostly because of ISIL's success in Syria and Iraq, of course, but also now because Boko Haram, despite the setbacks it may be experiencing in recent times, has a big chunk of Africa's most populous country where it's able to reign and exercise a lot of influence, create a lot of terror at a minimum. And ISIL's narrative depends on being able to say that they are realizing this jihadist vision of a takeover of much of the Middle East, creating this broader caliphate, and now perhaps even extending as far as Nigeria and Africa. So to the extent that Boko Haram and ISIL join forces, it reinforces the narrative at a time when we're trying to reverse the narrative, and specifically when the ongoing operations in Iraq are trying to reverse the amount of territory that ISIL is now controlling in the broader Middle East. So at least in the short term, I think it's a setback for us in the level of sort of the war of ideas, the war of ideologies, the sense of who's got momentum and who does not. Over time, I think we'll be able to reverse this. But in the short term, it gives those organizations a bit of a psychological boost and a recruiting boost for that reason.
Turning back to you, Peter Pham, with respect to Boko Haram's situation in Nigeria, you said that they're on the defensive. They are actually losing territory. Talk more about that, as well as Nigerian President Goodluck Jonathan's allegation that Boko Haram fighters are being trained at camps by the so-called Islamic State in the Middle East. He didn't mention any countries. What do you know?
Over the course of the past year, and we've discussed this on the show previously, Carol, Boko Haram has grown in the extent of the territory it held. And it seemed to be on a roll. The Nigerian military often retreated rather than fight. And in fact, just recently, they began a court-martial proceeding in Nigeria for two generals and a number of other officers for cowardice and running rather than fighting. In recent months, the Nigerian government has reshuffled the command of the two divisions which were most involved in the fight, put in new commanders. The big change was the neighboring countries, which had long acquiesced to Boko Haram using their territory essentially as a strategic depth, relying on the fact that there were ethnic ties of kinship to populations that straddled the borders of Niger, Chad, and Cameroon. And in fact, in some cases, these countries were complacent in enabling Boko Haram to function that way. They found that their interests diverged finally. Boko Haram got too greedy, too ambitious, and so the neighboring countries joined together. And for the first time, Boko Haram is being denied that sanctuary. So between new leadership, the changed political climate, and really a Nigerian government that facing a very tough re-election campaign because it's a very tight race. It's the most competitive race in Nigeria we've ever seen, and being hammered for the ineffectiveness of its campaign against Boko Haram, really took it seriously, has been on the offensive, and in recent weeks has driven Boko Haram at least out of formal control of almost all the local government areas in the states of Adamawa and Yobe that it had held. It still holds on to several local government areas in the state of Borno, which is Nigeria's largest state by territory. And so that fight continues. Now, as for President Goodluck Jonathan's comments about training in the Middle East, I don't have access to what sources of intelligence he may have. I just find it a little hard to believe in the sense that there are ISIS affiliates much closer by, much more accessible to Boko Haram. One thinks of the three vilayat or provinces of the Islamic State in Libya, which are literally a hop and a skip through Niger, down the Salvador Pass, and you're there. It would seem to be a more logical place if they were being trained outside Nigeria to train there than to try to get someone all the way to Syria or Iraq and then back again.
Back to you, Michael O'Hanlon. I'd like you to weigh in on to what extent you think Boko Haram fighters are being trained at camps run by ISIS in the Middle East, or what about the suggestion by Peter Pham that perhaps closer by in Libya, and we know that Libya is in chaos, and that, as a matter of fact, there are reports that Islamic State is finding a new frontier amid the chaos in Libya. It is coming under pressure from American-led strikes in Iraq. What are your thoughts with regard to the training and to what extent Libya is falling under the sway of the so-called Islamic State?
Right. I think you're raising all the right questions and issues because, just as Peter said, the idea of a Nigerian going all the way to Syria, getting trained and coming back requires multiple stops along the way, multiple border crossings. It's not impossible, but it's hard. Of course, a lot of what we're trying to do in the United States, working with our coalition partners, is to make this sort of movement harder in general for jihadists who might go to Syria. The numbers are staggering. There are probably 20,000 foreigners who have gone to Syria to fight in that nation's war. If you want to call what they're doing there also getting training, I guess you can. And so it's more that Syria and Iraq have become the center of the international jihad. Again, there are about 90 countries that are estimated to have sent fighters, you know, not by official policy in general, but because individuals have slipped through the cracks in the international system of controls and gotten to Syria. Many of them, when they get there, they realize that ISIL is a horrible organization to live under or fight with. They try to return home. They're usually killed if they try to come home. So again, if Boko Haram members go to Syria, they may or may not be able to leave alive, depending on what ISIL is desirous of at that stage. Right now, in the short term, there is this sense internationally that Syria in particular and Iraq are sort of where it's at for the international jihad. And again, there can be some propaganda in calling what they're doing cross-training. But I think you're probably right in the way you asked the question that the pathways up through Mali and Libya and elsewhere are closer and perhaps more realistic. Now, of course, once you're in Libya, you can conceivably try to get to Syria. And it just takes a boat ride across the eastern stretch of the Mediterranean to do that. So there is a certain amount of interconnectedness, which is why there are 20,000 jihadists from abroad inside of Syria today. But I don't think that Boko Haram is likely to be measurably strengthened by the return flow.
Well, briefly, before we go to a break, Michael O'Hanlon, what can you tell us about where you think Libya is going and how strong is the so-called Islamic State in Libya? We know they're in CERT now and they could potentially exploit, you know, the selling of oil, as they have done elsewhere, you know, to fund their brutal operations. How dangerous is the situation in Libya in terms of falling into the hands of the Islamic State militants?
Well, it's a nightmare. It's become a policy failure. There's just no other way to say it. You know, the overthrow of Gaddafi has, if anything, on balance, been a major setback for international security. I mean, who would have thought it when 4 years ago Gaddafi was threatening to butcher thousands of his countrymen and we went in with a NATO operation and tried to help protect them. And then there was an overthrow of Gaddafi and one assumed that Libya was going to see a much better day and that this would become a region of relative stability on the African continent, or at least better than it had been. But in fact, just the opposite is true. Now, I'm not sure ISIL is going to take over Libya, but it's going to have, just as you say, pockets of territory in Libya, perhaps some of them even with resources that it can profit from. If this goes on too far, at some point we're going to use airplanes to destroy the oil infrastructure that ISIL's trying to employ within Libya to get rich, and we're going to stop them from doing it. But in the short term, you'd rather not decimate all of Libya's infrastructure because the hope still is that the Libyan government can at some point reconsolidate and control its own territory. The problem is there is no such thing really as the Libyan government today, and they certainly don't control their own country. So ISIL, unfortunately, has much more free rein than we would have liked.
You're listening to Encounter on the Voice of America. My guests are J. Peter Pham, director of the Africa Center at the Atlantic Council, a policy group based here in Washington, and Michael O'Hanlon, from whom you just heard. He's senior fellow and co-director with the Center for 21st Century Security and Intelligence and director of research for foreign policy at the Brookings Institution. We're talking about the ramifications of the recent declaration by Boko Haram, the Nigerian terrorist group, that it has formally affiliated itself with the so-called Islamic State, also known as ISIS or ISIL. This is a reminder that our Encounter podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/encounter. You may also follow me on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA or like us and connect with us on Facebook. You may also send feedback via email to encounter@voanews.com. Either way, tell us where you're from and how you listen to the program. Here's a shout out to a very faithful listener, Caleb Ulasi from Enugu State in southeastern Nigeria. Well, back to you here in the studio, Peter Pham. We're coming up on the elections now in Nigeria, March 28th. They had been postponed as a result of the insurgency in the Northeast and some technical issues that the government had to deal with. You, at your organization, the Atlantic Council, just hosted two senior Nigerian officials talking about, you know, how they have no doubt that the upcoming elections will most likely be free and fair because they are getting the Northeast under control and these technical glitches are being overcome. But to what extent do you think Boko Haram will still be able to disrupt the elections and call into question their ultimate legitimacy and credibility?
Well, I think to be fair to the Nigerian authorities, they've actually achieved a lot more in the last few weeks than, and I'll admit I'm wrong, than I and many other analysts thought they would be capable of insofar as pushing back Boko Haram, at least from its formal occupation of certain towns. I think over close to three dozen towns have now they've been pushed out of. That's tremendous progress, and that has to be acknowledged. On the other hand, this is a group that's both an insurgency occupying territory and trying to govern it, and also a terrorist group. And as they've shown, even on the very day that last week when Abu Bakr Shekau pledged his allegiance to the so-called Islamic State, they sent four suicide bombers into Maiduguri, the largest city in the area, and set off a series of explosions that left dozens of people killed and more than 150 wounded. So it's still a lethal force as a terrorist organization. So has more territory been cleared and liberated? Yes. Will the election be able to take place across more, almost all of the national territory of Nigeria? Yes. But there will still be security challenges, and we have to acknowledge that there are going to be risks in some places. It will take a bit of courage, just like it previously did in Iraq and other places, to go dip your hand and your finger in the ink and mark it. There is going to be risk, and we have to be prepared for attacks during the voting and possibly for violence afterwards should the results be contested.
Turning back to you, Michael O'Hanlon, and I'd like actually to turn now toward Iraq and the operation that took place by Iraqi forces to defeat ISIL, ISIS, the so-called Islamic State, into Crete. We note that Iraqi forces raised the national flag over a number of landmarks into Crete. They were working with Iran-backed Shiite militias to chip away at the Islamic State's once firm grip over that city. So the question is, you know, how much of an inflection point is this, in your view, in terms of turning the tide in Iraq and displacing the so-called Islamic State and helping, you know, Iraq gain back its territorial integrity? Are you concerned that the Shiite militias on whom the Iraqi forces depend may mistreat the Sunni populations in those areas? And is that going to be a negative from this whole operation? What are your thoughts?
As much as I am worried about the difficulty of pushing ISIL out of Tikrit and then out of Mosul and out of places like Ramadi and other parts of Al-Anbar province, and this will take hard fighting and people will die and property will be devastated. Nonetheless, this is actually the smaller of our challenges, or of the Iraqis' challenges and the Syrians' challenges. There are two problems that loom even larger. You got at one of them. It's not just the humanitarian dimension of some Shia militias mistreating some Sunni civilians. It's going to be the potential for Sunni-Shia civil war essentially established even as ISIL is pushed out, because if the Shia conduct themselves in such a vengeful way that it doesn't just cause some humanitarian tragedies, but actually creates a broad-based political reaction against their presence, you could actually see Sunni populations throughout much of Iraq reassess whether they really want to push ISIL out or maybe start fighting against the Shia militias. And so you get a complex civil war with many different actors like you have in Syria today. So that's the greater issue there. And then speaking of Syria, of course, since we don't have a viable strategy right now for Syria and ISIL has a large swath of territory that it controls there, you have the potential for a lot of ISIL fighters to simply relocate. And you may have liberated much of Iraq and restored, at least temporarily, that country to government control, but at the price of worsening the ISIL presence and the threat to Syria. And so I'm afraid that while I support what's going on in Iraq more or less, I have these huge reservations, and they're not reasons enough for me to suggest that we call off the offensive, as if the Iraqis would listen to Americans on that anyway. But they are reasons for me to be very focused on these two remaining questions. How are we going to get the Sunni cities of Iraq policed by Sunnis, or at least largely by Sunnis, in the aftermath of the liberation, so that you don't have the potential for the civil war that I just referred to? And then how do we get a more serious strategy for Syria? Because right now we just don't have one.
Well, I want to follow up with you before I turn back to Peter Pham, because you have the Shiite-dominated government in Iraq, led by al-Abadi, saying they're taking pains to assuage the Sunni population over the role of Shiite militias and their Iranian advisors, saying that this is a national effort and it's not some kind of sectarian-driven fight. I mean, can we take them at their word? Do you see the possibility of this truly being a more harmonious outcome as opposed to the one you painted, which could pit the Sunni populations against the Shiite-led forces and militias that are wiping out the Islamic State's presence?
I think the answer to your question is yes, that there is distinct possibility here of a acceptable outcome. I won't call it a sterling or an excellent outcome, but I think there is the distinct possibility that because Prime Minister Abadi has been working very hard to govern more inclusively, because he is working hard with some American support to think through a strategy for how the Sunni police forces of the north and west of the country can be reconstituted and used quickly as the security force in the aftermath of the liberation, because in theory some of these Shia militias can be shut down or controlled by the government when needed. And finally, because frankly most of Iraq Shia don't want to be in Tikrit anyway. It's a part of the country that doesn't have many resources. It's historically Sunni part of the country. That's not the part of the country they would want to do ethnic cleansing just to be able to repopulate with their own brethren. That's a part of the country that they would be happy to see the Sunni live in. So there is a chance that, in fact, we will be able to see this all work out okay. But I'm afraid that it's a high-risk operation, and there's going to have to be a lot of attention paid to reconstituting the local Sunni police forces, which have essentially melted away in the face of ISIL control of these regions. And we're going to have to see a way to very quickly put them back together. I would have preferred that you could have created out of some of the tribal structures a Sunni National Guard that would have already been properly prepared for the holding mission or the secure and policing mission by now, prior to the offensive being launched. But alas, it didn't work out quite that way.
And just quickly, one last comment with respect to Syria, which is an ultimate disaster, humanitarian and otherwise. And many say that Bashar al-Assad is the root cause, in a sense, of the spread of the so-called Islamic State for reasons we can't go into. But his presence is a major irritant and an incentive for foreign fighters and others to go fight alongside these jihadi groups, including the Islamic State. What's to become of Syria, in your view?
Well, that is a big question. I'm glad you're doing a whole show on it. I think you're going to have some kind of a hybrid political model where, in the short to medium term, you don't actually envision either pushing Assad out or condoning Assad's continued rule. In other words, you shrink the territory that he is able to govern and police, and you make it clear to him he's never going to get back the areas that a moderate opposition would be able to control. And there's going to be this sort of confederal arrangement for as far out as it takes to have a successor to Assad in Damascus. And that is going to take a long time. But I think it's a more realistic way to talk about it than what we're doing today.
Well, thank you very much, Michael. Turning back to you, Peter Pham, just as in Iraq and Syria, the role of the United States will be crucial in trying to defeat jihadi groups, including the Islamic State militants. What about the U.S. role vis-a-vis Nigeria? What is the current U.S. policy? We know there have been some disagreements, that the United States has been reluctant to provide some military assistance, worried that the Nigerian military was violating human rights. Where do things stand now?
Well, I think until the Nigerian elections transpire and whatever result comes out of that is accepted, we're in a holding pattern with Nigeria. It's the nature of the beast, given the political context and the United States not wanting to appear to favor one side or the other in a very hotly contested race. After that, however, I think ultimately the United States will have to engage substantively and profoundly with Nigeria. There's no comparison between Nigeria and its neighbors. This is Africa's most populous country, almost 180 million people, a $500 billion economy that's the largest on the entire African continent. Unless Nigeria is key and center of the solution, there is no solution to this Boko Haram, much as the Boko Haram ISIS challenge in this region. But for the moment, the United States continues to assist the neighboring countries, Niger, Chad, and Cameroon, which are leading the way in this multinational regional African force to fight Boko Haram. Benin is also participating. U.S. has deep standing relationships with all four countries, in particular with Niger, which hosts two drone bases, has been a key counterterrorism partner for the better part of a decade. The U.S. is assisting with training. We work very closely also with our British and French allies in the region. The French have a regional counterterrorism force, Operation Barkhane, Sand Dune. But ultimately, we have to re-engage and re-engage profoundly with Nigeria, not just politically, but also on the military side and also the intelligence. There's some intelligence sharing, but we've heard complaints from the Nigerian side, at least, that they're not getting what they think they should be getting. There are reasons for this, but certainly these are all questions that will have to be addressed after we get past the Nigerian elections.
But another question that has to be addressed is, how sustainable is this military coalition to which you referred, Chad, Cameroon, Niger, Nigeria, trying to defeat Boko Haram? How sustainable is that without a proper long-term political strategy? Has the Nigerian government outlined a political roadmap that goes beyond, you know, militarily defeating Boko Haram?
On the military side, this is why Nigeria has to be engaged, because ultimately it's the only country capable of sustaining the military side of the equation in the region by itself. It has the economic wherewithal and the manpower to do it. But as you say, Carol, you're quite correct. A military solution is not sufficient. Military solutions can create a space physically and temporally, but it has to be followed by a political, social, and economic program of development and inclusion. Whether this is because of the election or because they've actually seen the light, Nigeria has actually begun to articulate, and the Office of the National Security Advisor has actually brought on a team of, interestingly enough, of therapists and some psychological experts to develop a program for countering violent extremism. Now, whether this is dressing for the elections or it's a change of heart, time will tell. But at least there's some recognition that it will take more. And there's certainly some development programs that have been started. Again, whether it's an election campaign thing or it's sustainable, it remains to be seen.
I'm afraid that's all the time we have on this edition of Encounter. I'd like to thank my guests, J. Peter Pham, Director of the Africa Center at the Atlantic Council, and Michael O'Hanlon, Senior Fellow and Director of Research for the Foreign Policy Program at the Brookings Institution. And thanks to Anna Zalewski for booking our guests. Our engineer was Keith Holmes. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Encounter on The Voice of America.
Encounter on The Voice of America. Encounter on The Voice of America brought together advocates and opponents debating the critical issues of our time in a freewheeling, no-holds-barred discussion of fact and opinion. Your host was Carol Castiel. Join us again next week for another Encounter on The Voice of America.